loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Democratic National Convention opened yesterday in the aftermath of party chairperson Debbie Wasserman Schultz's resignation over hacked emails. The Clinton campaign is blaming Russia for the email leak showing the DNC favored Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has endorsed Hillary Clinton, but will his supporters line up behind her? Thousands of Sanders supporters rallied against Clinton ahead of the DNC in Philadelphia and as the convention opened. On Sunday, people packed the main hall of a community center in Philadelphia to demand freedom for political prisoners on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. President Obama has the power to free all political prisoners held in federal custody. But first, we turn to Clinton's campaign allegations that Russia is behind the leaked emails showing the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, acted in a biased way, in a way that broke its own rules, to favor Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders during the primary process. We are joined by international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thanks for joining. Nearly 20,000 emails were released showing that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, did indeed do what it could to support Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. But the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC are fighting back by sort of changing the subject. They are going on national TV, on all the talk shows. It's in the front page of the New York Times. The real story is not about the DNC's illegal conduct, but about the fact that the release of the documents was from Russian intelligence agencies. Mark Sloboda, talk about the whole issue here. And I want to get into what do the facts say? What do the facts point to? Because when I look at the New York Times, when I look at the other U.S. mass media, there's not a whole lot of facts.
Yeah, Brian, I think if you look through the headlines in the last 2 days from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, the Huffington Post, the Boston Globe, any of the major Western newspapers or the television stations as well, you will find very little written about these leaked emails and their quite damning revelations that were released by WikiLeaks. Instead, what you will find is an almost ubiquitous bullhorn shouting deflection that accusations that these emails were given WikiLeaks by Russian intelligence. Now, there's a lot of problems with that. One is it's obviously avoiding the discussion of very pertinent and damning details that frankly point to the fact that the U.S. Democratic primary was corrupt and rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton, and that the DNC chair and her staff deliberately conspired so that the results of that election would favor Hillary. We will never know, in fact, whether they change the outcome of the election because the primary has already happened. And it doesn't seem that there's going to be any real accountability for this. The DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, finally she has stepped down, but she was immediately hired up without a blush, brazenly, by the Clinton campaign, in effect rewarding her for conspiring to rig the election for Clinton. And even President Obama came out with a statement praising with her for her work for the Democratic Party. I hope that the Bernie Sanders supporters react not lightly to this, because everything that they have done for the past year, all of the accomplishments they've made, have not only been disvaluated by what happened, but they've then been spit on by the hiring of Debbie Wasserman Schultz by Clinton in the aftermath of this, and the praise of her by the U.S. President Obama. There's the other question: is the allegations that the DNC was hacked, and then that this DNC emails were given to WikiLeaks by the Russians in order, so the narrative goes, to embroil the U.S. in political scandal and to ensure that Trump wins the election. There's a lot of problems with this, from the technical details of the identification by the Democratic National Committee that Russia was responsible for the leak, to the idea that being propagated around by very mainstream sources, this conspiracy theory that essentially says, it outright says, Donald Trump is a Manchurian candidate for Putin. I mean, those are the headlines. I mean, this is Jeffrey Goldberg. This is Paul Krugman. This is pretty much the entire establishment media.
No, it really is. I want to read to you, in fact, from the New York Times on this is the New York Times writing the next day after Sunday about Robbie Mook, who is Mrs. Clinton's campaign manager. She went on ABC this week and said, quote, that the emails were leaked by the Russians for the purpose of helping Donald Trump. And then Mook goes on to cite experts, but offering no other real evidence. Mr. Mook also suggested that the Russians have a good reason to support Mr. Trump. This is the New York Times, quote, again from the Times. The Republican nominee indicated in an interview with the New York Times last week that he might not back NATO nations if they came under attack from Russia, unless he was first convinced that the countries had made sufficient contributions to the Atlantic Alliance. Now, the experts, the only experts that the New York Times article mentions, and the only experts that exist on this, is an organization called CrowdStrike, a cybersecurity firm that was hired by the Democratic National Committee. In other words, they have contracts with the Democratic National Committee to investigate what happened, how these emails were leaked. But obviously, they have a material interest in assisting the DNC with its narrative, which, again, as you point out, it happened right after the emails came out. The chairperson of the DNC, Deborah Wasserman Schultz, had to step down to try to assuage Bernie Sanders supporters who are marching in the thousands as we speak in Philadelphia, chanting, lock her up, lock her up. But suddenly they changed the narrative to be the Russians, the Russians, the Russians. But it really becomes not just a campaign ploy. It also feeds into the larger political narrative of what might be happening if Clinton is elected, and I believe she will be elected president of the United States, in terms of U.S.-Russian relations.
Yeah, so CrowdStrike not only has multiple reasons, not only their financial advantage, but their reputation is on the line because they are the cybersecurity firm for the Democratic National Committee, and its information was stolen. In fact, Donna Brazile, a Democratic Party official, came out and said that, according to CrowdStrike again, that Russian military intelligence agencies, fronts, hackers, two of them have been in the Democratic National Committee servers for over a year. Now, what I find extremely preposterous about this is that supposedly the Russian intelligence agencies hacked the Democratic National Service for over a year, and yet the FBI and the National Security Agency, the NSA, have done and said nothing about all of this. They have not, these accusations are not coming from the FBI and the NSA. They are absolutely silent. They are not adding to it. They are not taking action. No one is calling for a proper investigation. They are not corroborating any of these details by the DNC or this private company. And in fact, other private security firms have said that this is a nonsense, that no such determination can be made. In fact, that there are good reasons to believe otherwise. I want to draw your attention to one in particular. It's a name you probably haven't heard before, Jeffrey Carr. He is the CEO of another cybersecurity firm, Taiya Global. He's also the author of several books on cyber warfare, and he has been a contractor to the Pentagon before, directly consulting on Chinese and Russian cyber warfare. In a series of blistering articles, he has completely attacked these allegations, both in the media and by CrowdStrike, and dissected them one by one. He's got he's on Twitter. He's got a blog. I strongly urge you, if you're interested, to look at the details, because there's a lot of details here. He dissects both the political narrative and the technical details, and it's well worth looking into. Without going into all of that here, we have to know that in the Western media recently, there have been accusations for the last 2 years all over the place. And evidently, Putin secretly controls, according to the Western media, a huge amount of the political establishment all across the West, not just in the United States. We're talking mainstream publications here have alleged, and I've compiled a list here. They say that Putin secretly controls the U.S. Republican Party via Trump, that they secretly control the U.S. Green Party, Jill Stein, their presidential candidate. The British press has accused that Russia is secretly influencing, backing Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the United Kingdom Labour Party, the shadow government. The Brexit campaign was said to be orchestrated or influenced or at least wanted by Putin. There have been accusations against the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD, simply because German foreign minister Steinmeier spoke out against NATO exercises on Russia's border as saber rattling. The Greek left, Tsipras and Syriza, the Greek far right, the French far right, Marine Le Pen and the National Front, the Hungarian right, Orban and Jobbik, the Italian Prime Minister Renzi, the Czech President Zeman, the Austrian far right, basically every other far right and far left party in Europe. There have even been accusations from major mainstream Western newspapers and publications that John Kerry is touting the Russian line and has been influenced by Putin, or that Boris Johnson, the British Foreign Secretary, is a puppet of Putin. Basically, if you adopt a position that is equivalent to the Russian government's position on any issue of international import, you are probably secretly controlled by Vladimir Putin.
So it's really Russia that's the unipolar power in the world. Interesting.
I'll tell you what, if Vladimir Putin really has this much power over Western governments' politics, they had better make peace, surrender with him, and probably everyone should erect a little shrine to him in their house and start worshiping him. It's just absolutely absurd.
We're talking to Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst from Moscow about the attempt by the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, that wrongly, illegally, double-standardly turned its resources to defeat Bernie Sanders and give the nomination to coronate Hillary Clinton, changing the subject about those released emails to make it that it's all about Russia. Russia, the evil empire, has come back to release DNC documents. Now, I want to just take this a step further, Mark, because we're not really joking about how far the hysteria has grown against the Russian government. I want to read again from that New York Times article, and the article is entitled, "As Democrats Gather, a Russian Subplot Raises Intrigue." Now, here's from the article. "Intrusions for intelligence collection are hardly unusual, and the United States often does the same, stealing emails and other secrets from intelligence services and even political parties. But the release to WikiLeaks adds another strange element because it suggests that the intelligence findings are being weaponized, used to influence the elections in some way," meaning the American elections. I mean, now the Russians have weaponized intelligence, unlike what the United States does. And I'm not granting them the idea that, in fact, this was a Russian hack. I mean, we don't know, but certainly the evidence and the source are suspect. But here they say the United States enters into other political parties, takes their information, carries out cyber attacks, but doesn't try to influence elections because that would be weaponizing intelligence. I mean, this is just so obviously absurd, because the whole history of the United States intervening all around the world in elections where the election results come out in a different way from what U.S. policymakers wanted, the U.S. just tries to disqualify the elections or describe them as a fraud or in some way or another undo them. But here it is. The Russians are coming. The Russians have weaponized intelligence. They're trying to influence the election. They're trying to throw the election to Donald Trump.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony and shade and fraud here because the U.S. quite openly, brazenly interferes in the political systems of other countries all over the world. What makes these accusations particularly cynical coming from the Clinton Foundation is New York Times articles revealing that Russian government-connected businesses gave Clinton $500,000 amid a Russian uranium deal while she was Secretary of State that she may have traded influence for. So she had really better watch accusations and the much greater evidence, if anything, that it's Hillary Clinton that's Putin's puppet.
Now, of course, you're being sarcastic, but we understand the irony of the situation. Here, the United States is carrying out cyber attacks and many other attacks against countries all over the world. But the presentation is that the Russians, again, are responsible for the revelations that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, tried to throw and used all of its resources to throw the election to Hillary Clinton in her contest with another person running within the Democratic primary, that person being, of course, Bernie Sanders. We've been joined by international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. On Sunday, people packed the main hall of a community center to demand freedom for political prisoners on the eve of the Democratic National Committee. This is a community center in Philadelphia where the DNC is taking place. President Obama has the power to free all political prisoners held in federal custody. We're going to talk about political prisoners in the United States. We are joined by Kashara White of the Black Radical Organizing Collective, who chaired the event, and her co-chair, Eugene Puryear, who is a show host with By Any Means Necessary. And we're joined by Teresa Schoetz. She also spoke at the event on behalf of her imprisoned father, Russell Maroon Schoetz. Welcome to the three of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, Eugene, let's start with you. We have an international audience. Of course, we have a U.S. audience. A lot of people around the world don't know that the United States has political prisoners, but you were there, all of you were there, a big crowd, demanding that President Obama take action now to give clemency to those held in federal custody, but also freedom for other political prisoners who are in state prisons. Talk about the event.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the event, which I thought was quite good, that was definitely attended by over 100 people and a number of people who were, you know, involved in the Democratic National Convention. There were some folks there who were delegates, also folks from Philadelphia. So it was very broad-based. I mean, the reality is that there are dozens and dozens of political prisoners inside of jails, inside of the United States of America. The vast majority of them are people who were arrested due to, you know, where various activities related to the liberation movements that grew up in this country in the 60s and the 70s, and some folks who continue to be active in the 80s. But certainly, this is a country that denies there's any political prisoners. Actually, similar to the early days of the Irish struggle, where they denied them political status and tried to treat them as criminals, this country denies political status to any prisoner, regardless of the nature of the struggle or the conflict in which they were involved in. It refuses to bring in any sort of political context. And so at the event, we had a number of people representing Leonard Peltier. Of course, Teresa Schoetz was on this show, and also her sister and brother were there yesterday as well. We had folks representing the case of Mamia Abu-Jamal. We had former political prisoners like Kazi Toure and Eddie Conway, who were also there speaking on the panel and talking. We had a message from the people's attorney, former political prisoner Lynn Stewart. And so we had a range of speakers and topic who were discussing not just the case of political prisoners that they are the most attached to, but also the meaning and the importance of the cause, the meaning, the importance of the support, and really underlying this idea that for these prisoners who are in federal custody, President Obama is able to free them with his commutation and clemency power, and that in the last few months of this year, 2016, that should and can be a big focus.
Yeah, I was at that meeting in Philadelphia, and we also had Noelle Hanrahan and Pam Africa representing the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who, of course, perhaps he's been in prison since 1981 for most of it on death row. But I want to talk to Teresa Schoetz. Teresa, you were there. I heard you speak. You and your siblings made an impressive presentation on behalf of your father. your father was held in solitary confinement for decades. Solitary confinement, that's really a form of torture. And it was the campaign that you waged that finally succeeded in getting him released to the general population. Talk about that struggle.
That struggle, it continues. I am happy to say that, yes, we freed him from solitary confinement. There were a number of reasons why I pushed forward and I began to really acknowledge what my dad was saying to me. It was that one visit behind glass, because, of course, we hadn't touched our dad, physically touched him, in more than 20 years. These visits continued behind glass, where I would take my son, who is 26, from the time he was an infant until he was grown. He always seemed marooned from behind glass, his grandfather. Or during one of those visits, I said, "Wow, Daddy, you're getting really gray. Your beard is becoming really gray." He said, "Gray? What do you mean I'm gray?" He said, "How gray? I've seen a couple of hairs in my comb, but what do you mean?" I said, "Oh, you're gray on both sides, say in the middle." He said, "What?" He said, "I didn't know that." I said, "Well, I know you say you comb it. Look, you see yourself in the mirror." He said, "I haven't seen myself in years. They don't give us mirrors. I have nothing to nothing that would show a reflection of myself." He said, "I haven't seen my face in more than 20 years. And it crushed me.
Amazing.
I mean, just speaking about it now, it was devastating.
Yeah, I mean, solitary confinement is torture. When you have somebody in prison for 22, 23 years, that's just... I mean, it's impossible, really, for someone who hasn't endured that to even conceive of what it means to be locked into a small cage for 22 years, 23 hours a day. He was a fighter for Black liberation. He was a fighter with the Black Panther Party. He was a struggler for justice. Keshara White, you're from a younger generation. The people I heard yesterday speak, either they were political prisoners who have been released, like Eddie Conway. He spent, I believe, 43 years in prison, 43 years for a crime he did not commit. But they're essentially people from the 1960s and early 70s, older folks now who are fighting for Black liberation. And one of the themes in the program yesterday was, not only did these individuals have to be remembered, not only did we have to make a connection to them and retain that connection and fight for their freedom, but they were the people who came before the current generation that's also struggling for Black liberation and equality and justice. Talk about how this impacts on young people and the movement today, if you would.
Well, right now, Brian, I'm working with the Black Radical Organizing Collective in Philadelphia. And we're working alongside Temple University's SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine branch. And they, the youth in Philadelphia really want to reconnect back to those revolutionaries. And we want the youth movement to be a movement of liberation for those people who have sacrificed so much for us. And so what SJP has decided at Temple is that they wanted to create a national campaign so that all the Students for Justice of Palestine make a commitment to working with the communities that those universities are pretty much placed in inside, but also a commitment to freeing political prisoners in Palestine and from Palestine, but also the Black radical political prisoners here in the United States as well. And so I think that this issue is really like energizing the youth, because at the end of the day, when these young people become radical, it is from the writings of Mumia and the speeches of Mumia Abu-Jamal and from the actions of the Mu family and of people like Ransom Arusha. And we need those people to be liberated from the prison cells because they are our leaders. And I think that that's what the youth are sort of coming around to being able to see, is that we can't have a movement to save Black lives that doesn't include incarcerated people.
Yeah, Eugene Pereira, it really is interesting. In some ways, there's been a generation gap because, or a generation skip, I would say. There was the very radical, profoundly massive movement of the 1950s and 60s and early 1970s. And that movement was suppressed. It was repressed. The people who are political prisoners today, they were part of a larger army of people who were sent to jail or who were, in many cases, even assassinated by the government. The government had COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, to hunt down and destroy all sectors of the black freedom struggle. And then there was kind of a period of ebb. In other words, a decline in the movement. But now the movement's picking up again. I mean, it's really, as we know, since Ferguson, people, the Black Lives Matter movement or whatever its iteration is called at different places and different times, it is still a mass movement sort of emerging. And as Kashara said, people are looking backward to see, well, what are the lessons from the 60s? What are the lessons from the 70s? Now, two of the speakers yesterday, Betty Davis from the New Abolition Movement, she said the hands up, don't shoot phase of the movement should be over, that it needs to take a more militant posture. Anthony Montero, another speaker at the event, he said, we are no longer interested in the politics of identity. We are interested in the politics of revolutionary change. In other words, as the mass movement comes back, all of the issues of slogans, of ideology, of philosophy and strategy and tactics comes to the fore.
Well, I think that's 100% true. And I should add that folks who want to actually see what was on the program at the Party for Socialism and Liberation Facebook page, which hosted it, you can see the video. And certainly, you know, this entire topic is something we discuss so much on By Any Means Necessary, my show. And I think that you are seeing that there is a radicalization when people see how difficult it is to make even the most basic changes to the system when it comes to the issues of policing in particular. Also, the movement itself getting its own political prisoners, Jasmine Richards, of course, on that ridiculous felony lynching charge out there in California. And so I think ultimately the course of events leads you to this element. I mean, I think the movement of the 60s was exactly the same way. I mean, it was a struggle for democracy that was able to sort of, in the most formal sense, achieve some of its gains. But then when it came up to some of the most basic economic questions underlying the reality of quote unquote democracy, the system itself hardened and it struck back directly at them. And there was a concomitant radicalization that happened at the same stage. I mean, I think this is natural. I mean, all struggles in this country that are reform struggles can go but so far. And at a certain stage in the game, the system in and of itself, I mean, even someone like Bernie Sanders, who had like no real radical program at all, just like a basic milquetoast progressive program, the whole Democratic Party establishment completely colluded to keep him down, which shows that there is a huge fear in this country amongst the quote unquote 1% ruling class, whatever you want to call it, to prevent any sort of large progressive upsurge to stop it. And I think we see that happening now as people are starting to realize that. And right here in Washington, D.C., where we're recording, for instance, a group of Young Movement for Black Lives advocates are organizing a whole month worth of events around Black August, which is the month that political prisoners are traditionally celebrated here in the United States in honor of George Jackson and the comrades who were there in Soledad.
The era in which Russell Maroon Shokes didn't want to see. He always told me, I didn't want to leave your family, leave you and your mother and your siblings, but I could not leave this rotten system for you to grow up in. And now it's come full circle again. As you said, those liberators, those people in the Black Liberation Movement were crushed, were placed beneath the prison or murdered. And with that came this insurgent now of injustice. And he didn't want to leave his system for the next generation, but he's happy to see that this generation has taken this fight up and that they're moving forward with it.
That was Teresa Schoetz. She is the daughter of Russell Maroon Schoetz. She and her siblings spoke yesterday in Philadelphia outside the Democratic National Convention at an event demanding that President Obama take action. He has executive authority. He can grant clemency, certainly, to those individuals who have been in prison now 20, 30, 40, almost 50 years because of their activism during the Black Liberation Movement of the 1950s and 60s. Teresa Schoetz, I want to just congratulate you, too, on the tremendous support that you generated for your father, who was in solitary confinement for more than 22 years. In other words, in that cage, you got the support of five Nobel Peace Laureates, including Desmond Tutu, and the UN Special Rapporteur, who called the sustained isolation of your father a crime and demanded that the U.S. government release him from solitary. I mean, I just want to congratulate you. And it does show the power of the people when the people are mobilizing.
I thank you, because for so long I was living in the American dream and I couldn't wake up. I totally depended upon the prison system to do the right thing and releasing my dad. And I would call them weekly from my job and ask, he's had, when will my dad be released? He's had good behavior over more than 20 years, no infraction. And they would say, time is coming. It wasn't until I made it public, until I called Juan Mendez, the rapporteur on torture, I just started calling folks who had the ability to take us to the next level. I wasted years thinking that this justice, this Department of Justice, this criminal system would do the right thing, in which I had to wake up out of the American dream and come to life and realize that they weren't going to do a damn thing but keep him as long as they could in solitary confinement.
Okay.
Until he died.
Yeah, that, thank you for that. Kashara White, we have 2 minutes left. I want to give you the last word. Teresa Schoed said, you know, people have to not be pretending that there is an American dream, to wake up, to take action, to go into the streets, to realize the power that they have. You're part of the Black Radical Organizing Collective. You're part of the young people who are in the streets day after day, not just during the Democratic National Convention, but certainly now during the Democratic National Convention. Again, how do you feel in terms of the movement's growth and development? Of course, it has ebbs and flows. But talk about the strategic sort of orientation of the movement right now. Is it oriented towards building bridges into the Black and Latino and other oppressed communities? How are you doing it?
Well, I think this movement is, you know, very eclectic right now. And that's a really good thing because it's vibrant. What we see now is sort of like overwhelming, like effort to attempt to co-opt this movement. And that's why you know that it's really strong and powerful. I see in the streets, Brock has this philosophy of intercivilizational communalism, which is this idea that people across, you know, ethnicities, people across religions to come together and fight the machine. And so I think that we get to see that not only in our organizing, but also in the organizing that's happening around North Philadelphia, and in particular with the stadium stompers. You have students, community people, transgender people, and Muslim people all working together to stop Temple University from building a stadium in a neighborhood. And so I think that this movement is really has really brought new life back to the left, and it has a lot of potential to be radicalized. So I'm really excited about that.
All right, we are out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Kashara White of the Black Radical Organizing Collective. She's in Philadelphia. There's demonstrations going on at the Democratic National Convention. We've been talking with Teresa Schoed. She is the daughter of Russell Maroon Schoed, who was held in solitary confinement for more than 2 decades, still in prison after all of these many, many years, demanding his freedom. And we've been joined in studio by a show host of By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik, Eugene Puryear. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Bernie Sanders has endorsed Hillary Clinton, but will his supporters line up behind her? Thousands of Bernie Sanders supporters rallied against Clinton ahead of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. They stayed in the streets Sunday and Monday. What will become of the momentum created by this campaign and the demands raised by it? We are joined from the site of a Bernie Sanders demonstration, that is a Bernie or bus demonstration, in Philadelphia by Jane Cutter. She is the editor of liberationnews.org website, and by Loud and Clear Radio Sputnik producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome, Jane and Walter.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So I was at the demonstration on Sunday in front of the DNC before it started. The people were chanting, "Hell no, DNC, we won't vote for Hillary." I mean, it doesn't sound to me, Jane Cutter, like the Bernie Sanders supporters, or at least the ones in Philadelphia in the streets demonstrating, are going to follow Bernie Sanders and support Hillary Clinton.
You are absolutely right. They are not going to do that.
Okay, talk about it.
Well, I mean, they've been doing their research, and they know exactly who Hillary Clinton is, and they want no part of it. They want no part of her imperialism and her warmongering stance that she took as Secretary of State. They don't like her racism, her involvement in the creation of mass incarceration, neoliberal policies. They want no part of it. And that's, you know, they pride themselves on being free thinkers who don't, they're not in this to do whatever they're told. They've come to their own conclusions. We just saw a man, just one of the many thousands walking as we were walking to do this interview, and he was holding a sign that said RNC equals DNC equals MSM, mainstream media, equals 1%. And I said, you know, I asked him about a sign. He says, you know, it took me a long time to figure it out, but yeah, this is what I believe. So they have a systemic, a lot of them have a systemic understanding of what's going on. And so they're not going to, you know, they're not going to be bullied into voting for the so-called lesser of two evils.
Walter, let me ask you, who's there? Who are the demonstrators? Who are you seeing? Are they young? Are they old? Is it multi-generational? Is it black, Latino, white? Is it representative of America? And talk about the anger level, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, just to pick up on the anger level part, I mean, I think it's a very impressive show of militancy. I mean, Never Hillary is another chant that I've heard many, many times. People say it with, you know, a lot of force and anger and militancy, because they understand that, you know, they've been cheated by the DNC, that the primary process was it's a rigged game. The superdelegates are in control. The party machine is in control. And people are completely fed up with it. In terms of the composition of the crowd, you know, I think it's quite impressive that it is, in fact, multi-generational. You know, of course, Bernie Sanders' most reliable voting bloc in the primary were young people under 25. And, you know, they're certainly very well represented. And I think that's, you know, a testament to the strength of the campaign. But, you know, there are definitely people from all age groups here. And I think that the message of the Sanders campaign, you know, against equality, against the you know, the domination of the 1% over, you know, the economy and politics and the media, you know, that's something that cuts across many demographics. As has been pointed out throughout the campaign, you know, it's a primarily white crowd, and that remains the case. We'll see later on tomorrow at the DNC, there's going to be a demonstration organized by Black Lives Matter activists called the Black Resistance March. There's going to be, I think, a significant presence of anti-racist demonstrators along with the pro-Sanders supporters. So it remains to be seen if those two forces will merge. And I think if that does happen, it'll be a very powerful thing.
Jane Cutter, you wrote an article on liberationnews.org website about the impact of the email revelations, there was a hack of the DNC emails. 20,000 emails were dumped, were released just as the convention was opening. The emails certainly had to be a big factor in terms of arousing additional anger from the Sanders supporters. Talk about the emails, what they said, and why or how they're impacting people where you are in Philadelphia in the streets.
Sure. I mean, so the emails really just prove what Bernie Sanders supporters have been saying all along, which is that the Democratic National Committee was not playing, as it is supposed to play, a neutral role in the primary process, but was clearly favoring Hillary Clinton and was actually conspiring against the Bernie Sanders campaign in a number of ways, and then attempting to play that they were neutral on the outside. So one of the very telling emails, they were talking about how they should make a thing about Sanders' religion, that he's an atheist, that he's of Jewish descent, that this would hurt him in more conservative Christian areas. They don't actually mention his name, but it's clear who they're talking about, because what other candidate of Jewish descent is there in the current presidential race? So there's that. There's a lot of different ones where they just show their absolute contempt for Sanders and his campaign. And they talk about one of the very telling ones also is about Rhode Island. They talk about how, you know, Sanders was polling 4-1 over Clinton in Rhode Island, and then also that the governor closed a number of many of the polling stations. And then they say, well, the Rhode Island governor is one of ours, but we should probably say something just to get out ahead of this issue. to make, in other words, to make it look like we're neutral, we should say something about this blatant voter suppression that's going on in Rhode Island. Because if we don't, the Sanders people will make a big deal of this and yell about voter suppression, which they did. So it shows that they knew what was going on, that they were in collusion with this voter suppression, and they perceived it, that they were on the same page with the governor in doing that, really. But they were just trying to cover their tracks.
That's Jane Cutter. She is the editor of liberationnews.org website. Her article is entitled "Leaked Emails Show DNC Plotted Against Sanders Campaign." That's on liberationnews.org. Jane, I want to just stay with you about that email, the one that you were talking about and talked about in your article, which I encourage our listeners to go and read that article. You know, I want to read from the email. Again, these are the hacked emails of the DNC's internal email list. The DNC is supposed to be a facilitator for all of the candidates as they go to the voters. And in fact, the DNC, the top individuals, the governing force there, the officials, including Deborah Wasserman Schultz, who's been forced to resign because of the email release on the eve of the convention, they clearly were aiming to torpedo Bernie Sanders, just as Sanders had alleged. They say this: new reports show Rhode Island government opening only a fraction of polling locations. That's what you're talking about in the story you just mentioned. And even though she is one of ours, we need to say something because it's going to be so obvious that the DNC, the Clinton campaign, the Clinton apparatus is working to torpedo Sanders rather than facilitating the primaries. That's what you're talking about.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. It's, you know, and so this is the kind of thing that just makes people furious. They suppress the vote. They do everything they can to torpedo it. They lie about it. And then when they're caught, they say, you know, as in the case of the guy who was trying to use Sanders' religion, "Oh, I'm sorry if I offended anybody." And then, you know, Schultz resigns. Well, she will be resigning. She's will resign at the end of the convention. But then she's going to become the honorary chairperson of Clinton's campaign. So there's no real sanction for her whatsoever. She's going to get to carry on as usual.
Walter, you are the producer for Loud and Clear, this show. You're in Philadelphia covering the demonstrations. You're with the Bernie Sanders supporters who are in the streets. They've been in the streets for a couple of days, thousands of them. And we're talking about the email release and its impact. As Jane Cutter mentioned, and as our listeners probably know, Deborah Wasserman Schultz, as a consequence of the release of these emails, was forced to step down. But then she was immediately hired by Hillary Clinton to be a senior official in the campaign. And the Clinton campaign said, and I think this is remarkable, Deborah Wasserman Schultz is a good choice to be a senior official because she will continue to be our surrogate. That's their language, our surrogate, meaning our proxy. Of course, they are admitting, in fact, that she was their surrogate when she had the position of chairperson of the Democratic National Convention. I mean, if the Sanders people, Walter, are so outraged by this obvious sort of confirmation that what they thought was true is true, that the DNC had rigged the election, what will they do in November? Obviously, they're in the streets right now, but when you hear them talking, when you hear them chanting, where are they going politically?
Well, one thing that's clear, I think, is that they will not be voting for Hillary Clinton. I mean, some will, under the very intense pressure that, you know, is of course going to come as we get closer to November. But, you know, if their determination, their militancy is any indication, it appears that many, many thousands here in Philadelphia, representing millions across the country, will not yield to the blackmail that the Democratic Party machine is going to, you know, with escalating force, sort of try to impose on them. I mean, there's a lot of interest in independent progressive candidates. There's Jill Stein of the Green Party. There's Gloria LaRiva of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And I think that people, while they may realize the obstacles in terms of electability, they're also fed up with the lesser of two evils argument, which was essentially Hillary Clinton's entire campaign pitch. You know, people are tired of voting for evil, and they want somebody who represents their values and their interests. And so people, I think, are still forming their opinion of what exactly they're going to do. I think people will start thinking feel more seriously about that after this convention, after the very many demonstrations that are going to be happening. But I think that independent third-party progressive candidates stand a chance to do very well, both in terms of the sheer number of votes that they'll get, but also the number of volunteers that will be motivated to mobilize for their campaign, to volunteer, to try to get the word out.
Jane Cutter, in the liberationnews.org website, you made the point that your website made the point that Hillary Clinton chose Cain as the vice presidential nominee, and that Cain has historically been anti-choice, anti-abortion, but also pro-war. How does that weigh with Sanders supporters? I mean, Sanders supporters in general not only support social rights, individual rights, women's rights, they're anti-racist, they're also very anti-war.
That's correct. Yes, they very much are against war, against the imperialist stance that's been taken by the United States, and they're sick of it. They are very much sick of it, and they instinctively reacted to the nomination, the selection of Cain as the worst possible choice, and it was really like perceived as a slap in the face to the Sanders movement to say, we really don't care what who you would even like to see as VP. We're going to pick this extremely conservative, anti-abortion, pro-war person and make him the VP choice. It's not balancing the ticket in any way, shape, or form. It's making a very clear statement about what the politics of the Hillary Clinton candidacy really represent.
Walter, I want to ask you, how big of a deal do you think it is, the email release, in terms of impacting on Hillary Clinton? We had the FBI director say, okay, Hillary Clinton was extremely careless, which would be another way to say those words would be criminally negligent in the way she handled top secret information when she took all of the State Department emails and put them on a private email server. Of course, that would make them also not susceptible to Freedom of Information Act requests. In other words, hiding from the public. Now you have the leaked emails that say that the DNC fundamentally operated as a proxy, as a puppet, or as a surrogate for Hillary Clinton. But at the same time, you have the mass media now sort of changing the narrative about what that means. You have Bernie Sanders supporters in the streets chanting, lock her up, lock her up. But when I'm looking at the mainstream media newspaper articles like the New York Times, the story is all about not that they illegally used the DNC as a surrogate, but that the Russian government was probably the hackers, or Russian intelligence agencies were the subject or the force behind the hack, and that this is the Russians' way of helping Donald Trump. Does that impact on the Sanders supporters? Does that sort of dominant narrative, or narrative that's becoming dominant, does it impact on them?
Well, I mean, I think the Sanders supporters see the leaked emails as just another slap in the face. It might be, sort of the final nail in the coffin in terms of, their consideration of voting for Clinton as a lesser of two evils. I think the Russian hacking storyline is just so fantastical to a lot of people. And the other thing is that I think one of the main takeaways for many Sanders supporters is that the mainstream media is an arm of the 1%, right? This is, sort of a fundamental truth, like Jane was mentioning. A lot of people really have internalized that. And I think especially the young people who have been mobilized by the Sanders campaign, I mean, the mainstream corporate media, they've lost them for life. I mean, they're not going to believe another word that they say. So I think that, it's become clear. And, of course, it's not just sort of the public relations thing that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and other top DNC staffers were emailing each other about. There's also the case of the Hillary Victory Fund, the so-called joint fundraising vehicle that the Clinton campaign and the DNC had, which, was theoretically going to split the proceeds between the various state Democratic parties, the national DNC, and the Clinton campaign, which is legal. But what we found was that it was essentially a money laundering operation where almost all of those donations would be immediately funneled back into the Clinton campaign. I mean, I think people are well aware of the corruption of both the DNC, of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, of Hillary Clinton. And this confirms that yet again. And I think that they're going to sort of just roll their eyes at any kind of fantastical narrative about Russian hackers or a foreign plot to support Donald Trump.
Okay, Jane Cutter, we're going to give you the last word in the last minute. Donald Trump has tried to take advantage of the email leaks and the anger from the Sanders supporters about the email leaks and what it shows. He's saying it shows the system is rigged, meaning the Democratic Party. That's why you, Bernie Sanders supporters, should support Donald Trump in the November general election. What are you hearing on the street? Do you think that people in the Sanders campaign who are protesting could be supporters of Donald Trump?
Highly unlikely. I think they're resonating very strongly with, you know, messages of no Trump, no Clinton. If they hate everything that Hillary Clinton stands for, they hate everything that Trump stands for, too. I mean, and he's, you know, in a very offensively racist, in-your-face racist. They hate that, too. They're very much opposed to what he stands for, equally with what Hillary Clinton stands for. It's not just a, you know, we hate Hillary club. It's, you know, it's really people are seeing a systemic thing, and they understand that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are two sides of the same capitalist electoral coin.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We want to thank our guests. They're in the streets in Philadelphia with Bernie Sanders supporters who are outside the convention chanting lock her up about Hillary Clinton and hey, hey, DNC, they won't support Hillary. But that's all the time we have. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.